The method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to the first episode of Unsound Methods in 2019. I'm Lachlan Bloom.
And I'm Jamie Batchin. Happy New Year and welcome back.
For those of you who've not listened to the podcast before, this is part of a series where we talk to fellow writers about their process and technique and some of the motivations for their writing.
Yeah, and in this month's episode, we have a returning writer in the shape of Emer McBride.
Yeah, it was really great to have the chance to speak to Emer for a second time after we spoke to her initially in... Was it June last year at the French Institute? And yeah, we had a really good chat there, but we didn't really have enough time to get through all the questions we wanted to ask. So it was good to speak to her again later in the year.
Yeah, in our previous chat, we were catching her just before an event that she was doing, and we spoke to her alongside Naomi Lefebvre.
Yeah, and yeah, it was good that we had the chance because we got into a lot more of the nuts and bolts of Emer's approach. I find it interesting her reliance on her memory alone rather than relying on notes. Personally, if something seems like a good idea, my first urge is to rush and write it down somewhere to record it and prevent it slipping from memory. But
I totally agree with you. She has much more faith in her memory than I think either of us do.
But I mean, it evidently works. And yeah, I think it was interesting as well that she sort of seemed to follow that through into the redrafting process as well, and what worked was what she remembered. So when she was rereading something, if she didn't remember it, she would cut what she didn't remember from a previous draft,
which I think is quite an interesting approach, isn't it? Like if you feel when you go back and read through it, if you don't remember writing that bit, cut it out. I think that would be a very interesting way to try going about it.
Also, I think it was interesting hearing how she read everything through, and even if she had a, you know, down to the level of rereading a paragraph continuously for hours until she got it right.
Which, yeah, it clearly works. So, for those of you who haven't heard the previous episode with Emer McBride, it's not essential to listen to it to get what we're talking about in this episode. But if you are interested, it is episode 12. It came out in mid-August, and we also put up the audio recording of the event that happened after we had had a chat with Emer and Naomi.
Mm. I think that, yeah, that event, it had, the audio has Emer reading as well, so you can hear the cadence and the rhythm in her reading there.
Okay, without any further ado, ladies and gentlemen, Emer McBride for a second time.
Okay, so thank you for joining us again, Emer.
My pleasure.
I thought we could start today by asking you, following on from the previous chat we had with you, about how the processes were different for writing both A Girl Is a Half Form Thing and The Lesser Bohemians. We covered a little bit the fact they took different amounts of time, but how was your approach different?
Well, I suppose they both started with exactly the same idea and both became completely different books to the original idea, which was my rip-off of Ulysses' idea about a girl walking down a road over the course of a day. I don't think I arrived at them with different approaches in mind. They just both naturally came the way they did. I think, you know, A Girl Is a Half-Formed Thing, like a lot of first novels, sort of poured out. I don't generally like to say that because it's not true that it just happened. It was a lot of work, but it had an urgency to it, and that just propelled it out more quickly and more. It was much more fully formed by the end of the first draft than Lesser Bohemians, which took a year to write the first draft. And the final draft, you know, 8-9 years later, was almost unrecognizable from that first draft.
And how many, I know it's very difficult to say this is one draft, this is a second draft, but how many kind of distinct iterations do you think it went through in that time?
Lesser Bohemians. Well, I think after I did draft 5, I started calling things draft 5.2 and draft 5.2 radical draft, and just to hide from myself the amount of drafts that it was taking. So I would say it probably took about 7 or 8 drafts, really.
And what's your process when you go from draft 4.9 to draft 5? Where do you start? Do you go from the very beginning, page 1, and work through methodically, or do you kind of have a master plan of bits you need to fix in the next draft by the time you get to the end?
There's never any master plan. That doesn't work at all. For me, everything has to happen in the moment. So I have to start at the beginning and I have to go all the way through, and I can't skip a bit. If I get stuck, I have to stay with it until I solve it. Because the logic has to come out of the previous logic. It can't just land because I like the idea of a scene or a character doing something. It has to be believable. And in a way, that's why those early drafts became so big and took so long, was it was me working out a whole lot of logic, which later on I realized the reader didn't need to be privy to.
And does most of the inspiration for the revision come sort of at the coalface, so to speak, when you're actually sat down in front of the page? Or is it more likely you'd be out on a walk or around town and suddenly think, that's what I need to do, and then rush back or change it when you get back to the
I think page? there's sort of both. I mean, for most of Lesser Bohemians, there wasn't a whole lot of life outside. At least for the first 6 years, there wasn't much but just writing constantly. And, you know, sometimes for 16 hours a day. Then later on, obviously, I had my daughter, and then Girls Have Fun Thing was published, and there was touring and all the sort of faff that goes with publication. And that did involve having to take time away from writing. And then... But that had its uses, because there were those moments where your mind was just elsewhere, suddenly focused in on an idea and solved a problem. Mm. But in a way, I feel as though, or I felt as though, maybe until a year ago, until about a year after the book was published, I was still solving it. Every day I would wake up in the morning, the first thing I would think about was the book and how to solve this, and have to remind myself that it was too late, that it was already published. There was nothing more to be done.
Would you ever return to it? Because some writers do, don't they? Sort of years
after. I know they do. I would never return to it. I think that's it. It's done and it's out in the world now and it has its own life. But to the characters, certainly. Mm-hmm. Certainly.
Because when we were speaking last time, you said that you had envisaged it as being the first part of a trilogy, which is something I want to ask about, a question related to that as well. But is that because the characters became so much a part of you that you just wanted to spend more time with them?
Yeah, I think so. And it was around about the time I finished maybe the second draft of it, so very early on in the many years of writing, where I suddenly realized that even though I knew how that book would end, I wasn't done with them, that I was still interested in them, and that also who they are and what they represent are such a big part of what I'm interested in and in writing about, that why would I throw them away and start again with other people who will probably end up being quite similar to them.
Yeah.
More interesting to progress it forward and see what happens.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. That answers the question that I think we had afterwards. It was one of the reasons we want to speak again, because you said that you write based on the sort of logic of what you're writing, then it has to be true. And if you look back over it and it's sort of telling lies, you can't carry on with it. You need to fix it. And I felt from that, I wondered, well, how you're talking about a trilogy. So at what point did you realize that you felt there was a broader scope? But okay, so it's in a second draft, give or take, the first.
Yeah, time. I could see a life beyond. And I knew that wasn't part of the Lesser Bohemians. I knew how that book had to end, where I wanted it to end. But I could see that there was a lot more life ahead that I would be interested in looking at.
And is it the form of a trilogy? Is there any thought behind it, as opposed to having a sequel or a larger series of?
Well, I think, you know, it's as with a lot of my writing life, I usually end up doing things that I have a huge internal opposition to. I always thought that trilogies were incredibly tacky and hoped and thought I will never do such a terrible thing as write a trilogy. What a load of garbage. And that, of course, that then became interesting to see if, and because it felt as though there was a truthful life that could be built into a trilogy, it suddenly seemed something worth trying to tackle.
And is that something then that came as a sort of realization at one point, or do you tend to sort of mull things over more and come over a few weeks think, actually, this could be a trilogy? Or was it one day you sort of sat down and thought, aha, now I see it, it's a trilogy?
To be honest, it's so long ago, I can't remember exactly how I arrived at that point. I think I just began to see things that I wanted to investigate and then realized that those things didn't belong in the same place.
Mm.
And that there was a time, there had to be a time lapse between them.
Yeah.
What's the sort of scope of the trilogy that you're imagining? Is it because you've written about people younger than you and sort of obviously a period of life that you've been through, so that's you're able to understand and grasp that. Will it end up with someone much later in their life as a sort of imaginative work?
I'm probably not going to tell you that.
Okay, that's fair enough.
You'll have to wait and see.
So we spoke a little bit last time as well about the work you're doing with the Beckett Research Centre.
Yeah.
Is that in the University of Reading?
That's right.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And at the end of that, you're going to work on an imaginative piece or anything you want, in fact, you said, that was based on...
That's right. The remit was that I would just come and spend 15 days in the archive looking at whatever I wanted in the archive and then go away and produce an original work.
Mm-hmm.
That came out of that experience. So I have recently finished that, which I'm very glad about because I was sweating blood for several months wondering whether anything was going to happen. But turns out Beckett's quite inspirational. Who'd have thought it?
And surely they must give you the leeway to need more time to mull. I mean, was there a period of time after which you have to produce something? Because that would be quite forced, I'd imagine.
No, I think, I mean, they were very open about what it would be. So it could be anything. And obviously, if I was going to write a novel based on it, I couldn't write that within that year of the fellowship. I don't think they had necessarily thought out that problem. But in the sort of negotiations at the beginning, I think they realized that there was going to have to be an element of, we'll just have to see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, luckily for me, the pieces that I came up with in the end, I was able to write within that period of time. I felt like the moment had arrived and I sat down and I did it. But I think it's going to be interesting to see how that fellowship evolves with whoever comes next, because it's so open, it can be anything that you choose to produce as a result. And I know their next fellow is a composer.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that again is going to be a very different process.
Yeah. And what sort of documents did you have access to? I mean, it's the archive of everything you had, but were there sort of early drafts of things there?
Yeah, or? I mean, they have the original manuscript of Murphy there, which is obviously terrifying to be in close proximity to, but which is, you know, kind of extraordinary because it's all handwritten. The first drafts are all handwritten in his terrible, illegible handwriting. And then, you know, you can follow him along as he's writing and then doing a huge amount of scoring out, and then has clearly had a moment where he stopped and done a little caricature of James Joyce, or, you know, done a little picture of Charlie Chaplin and then gone on and did a bit more writing. You know, so there's a lot of that, which is very interesting about the, especially the handwritten documents and early drafts, where you can literally see a writer at work in a way that you can't anymore, because people tend to write either on laptops or the arcane typewriter. But that kind of longhand is fascinating to see.
And do you think from the evidence that still exists, you were able to understand the process that he went through, or is it the fragments are not enough to piece that together?
No, I mean, I think you can't ever really understand the process that a writer goes through, and sure, I don't even know what my own process is. Half of that is mystery to me, which is why I don't really mind talking about it, because I know that I can't ever really, you know, offer up a perfect explanation of it. But it's interesting to see all those things that are said about Beckett, about his, you know, being very precise and about being very harsh on himself as a critic, and to see that actually lived out in those pages where you can just see that there's a whole lot of writing being done and then he's just gone back with a pen and crossed it all out. And then sometimes he's drawn a line through it and then a line of X's and then another scribble over that. So he really wants to make sure that no one can see what that was. And that's kind of interesting to see the control freakery at work, actually.
And also a sense of posterity that must have been linked to that.
Well, like, clearly, you know, he didn't want anyone to see that. Yeah. And even in works like Murphy, where he had no reason to expect that anyone would ever care to see it or not to see it, he's still, you know, very, very cautious about it.
Yeah, it's fascinating. As you say, it's something that's gone now. If you don't want anyone to see it, you just hit delete and...
And that's it. Gone. Yeah. There's stamp on your hard drive at the end.
I think it's... Not something that it's ever likely to come back. You can't see.
No, I mean, I think there are some writers who still write longhand, but, you know, very few in comparison to the amount of times you get asked at festivals, do you write, do you type, or do you write longhand? And
speaking of which, do you write?
I type. When I had early drafts of something that I was working on before Girl, stolen, my house was burgled, it was just sort of 2 years worth of work handwritten in notebook, that was the end of longhand for me. Then it was always type it up, email it to myself at the end of the day.
Do you write anything in longhand? Do you write notes, or do you have a notebook?
I don't take a lot of notes, because I tend to think if it's good I'll remember it. And if it's not good, I will waste time trying to work in something that I thought was a good idea.
Have you ever been in the situation where you've remembered that there was a good idea, but can't remember what it was?
I've had that moment where I thought, oh, bloody hell, that was a good idea. But now I don't know what it is. But then I think, well, if it was that good, I would have remembered it. So
that's so brave. I don't know if I could ever trust myself to feel like that. Yeah, okay.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I will have no shortage of shit ideas in my life, so I don't need to record those. Yeah. The really good ones I trust I'll recall.
Going back to Beckett, and one question I wanted to ask, and to do with language, like your style is often quite sparse, or there's not traditional grammatical structures. Similarly, Beckett and Joyce. And I wanted to ask how you see writing in English, being Irish. I'm Scottish, and I remember the privilege of learning language before writing anything. You hear words that are not used in received pronunciation. And there's a sort of dissonance or a gap between what you hear people saying and speaking in everyday life and what you then start to learn as the correct English. I wondered how you see that playing into your writing, if it does at all. And
well, I think it's different in Ireland, actually, because I think that gap has always been quite narrow. I think the use of Hiberno English has always been very strong in Irish literature, and that, you know, was part of the two fingers to the colonists, really, was, you know, well, you've stamped out our language and made us take up yours, but see what we're going to do to it. And that was, I think, always a badge of honour. And you see that right the way through Irish literature written in English.
Was that something at school, when were you aware of a difference between the way you should write something according to the primary teacher and the way that you understood it existing in the world?
No, I mean, there was obviously a difference between, you know, kind of colloquial slang. You wouldn't write that. But, you know, we were taught Frank O'Connor stories at school, you know, which were always written in Hiberno English and things like that. That was never considered to be of lower standard than, you know, Emily Bronte. That was Irish literature could always hold its head up and was never the poor cousin. That was certainly not my feeling when I was growing up, that Irish literature has always, you know, punched above its weight internationally. And that's the one thing we have always known about ourselves and taken great pride in. And sometimes to the detriment of other things, perhaps, as well. But
do you think that it is that reaction against the kind of occupying culture is such a loaded way of putting it? But I wonder often why it is that Joyce and Beckett come from Ireland and, you know, sort of, and up to more modern writers as well. I mean, there is something. The Irish seem much more happy to embrace the kind of more experimental, again, is another horrible word to use, but side of the novel than the English. I don't know. I can never quite put my finger on why that is. I'm sure there's...
Well, you know, I think entire university courses have been, you know, lived and died upon sorting out that. I think there are a lot of reasons. I think the refusal to take up received pronunciation and correct English is a big part of it. And I think also the kind of the stolen language and its rhythms and its patterns and its reflexivity is very big part of how English is spoken in Ireland. That exists very strongly and always has. And I think once you start to kind of pull the straitjacket of English over the kind of the history of Ireland and the linguistic history of the language and the literature, you get very odd shapes. And the Irish have always been very willing to embrace that and celebrate that, you know, and they've been far more liberal in their embrace of language than many other things. In the 20th century.
But even when you're writing at school and stuff, if you're a child doing a creative piece in Ireland, are you still, is there more leeway given to that? Or is it,
it's a very long time since I was a child at school in Ireland. But I don't remember anyone ever trying to kind of beat the Irishness out of our English. Mm-hmm. I don't recall that ever happening.
Yeah.
And when you're writing now, are you trying to capture a sort of internal voice that, as you hear it, or are you trying to consciously change that voice if there is a voice that you hear? Is it a case of trying to sort of almost notate as it sounds natural to you in your head, or are you sort of looking at it from other aspects of construction and deliberately maybe trying to disrupt the grammar to have an effect on the reader, say? Or
I think it depends on what I'm doing, you know, and I think Beckett is an interesting example of that, of someone who started to write in another language just so that they could escape the demands of the Irish within them. And I've often envied him the fact that he could write in French and I could definitely never write in another language. But I think I'm not thinking about Irishness particularly when I'm writing, probably more when I was writing Girl as a Half-Home Thing. Obviously it's so Irish in so many ways. It's so set there and the rhythms are so Irish and the language is so Hiberno and all of that. But even in that, I wasn't trying to replicate naturalistic speech patterns, but trying to replicate sort of naturalistic life patterns and then throw lots of different bits of punctuation in to disrupt it so that it was apparent that it was about something that was going on inside rather than something that was passing logically through the brain.
Would you find then that you might write something as somebody might naturally say it or sort of think it, so to speak, and then look back and think, no, I want to I want to change that.
I think not when there was reported speech in it, because that was an important way of conveying information. So you often, a lot of the things that she hears in that book are quite naturalistic. But things that were coming from inside her would disrupt a lot. With the Lesser Bohemians, you know, it was kind of, there was a sort of a fun game with that, because she's obviously Irish and he's English, but his mother is Irish, so he's allowed some Irishisms. But at the same time, you know, there's a scene which he's trying to teach her how to speak in received pronunciation, and how he can hear her accent in a way that she can't hear her accent, and he kind of does it for her so that... And I like that, the idea of people kind of hearing and not hearing themselves.
Thank you for listening to Unsound Methods.
You can find us on social media at Unsound Methods on Twitter.
Online at unsoundmethods.co.uk.
I was wondering if we could just go back to something that you had said previously about the internal logic of the work that you work on, how you constantly rework things, and if it's not being true to you, it's not working. We asked you in the last podcast about when you know that something is finished, and you said that it kind of stops nagging at you, and at that point it's kind of, you know, okay, that's it, it's done. Yeah. And I wonder what your strategies are for something that is, say, a 300-page novel, I don't know what that is in thousands of words, but how you get that perspective, like, is it just all retained in your mind, or is it, do you need to sort of print it out and break it up and view it later?
I think it depends. I mean, with Lesser Bohemians, there was obviously a point when that was 800 pages long, and that required drastic action to deal with that. And so my simple rule for that was, go back to the beginning. If I don't remember this, cut it. So anything that I didn't remember was cut. And that actually got rid of a whole load of extraneous detail immediately, and scenes and bits of action and all sorts of stuff, because I knew if it was important, I would remember it. Bit like the great ideas, you know. And so there's that, and so then you get down to what you think are the essentials, and then for me it's just, you just go through, it's just line by line, and then, you know, then because the closer you're looking at, the more you remember it, and you think, oh, I've already said that, so cut it. You only need to say it once. You don't need to keep saying it over and over again. You don't need to keep re-explaining to the reader why you're doing such a good job as a writer, you know? You only need to make sure they understand something one time and then leave it.
And through that revising process, have you noticed any trends within your writing yourself that you tend to, I don't know, change more often, come back and change direct speech, or you more often come back and notice things are repeated, or are there any aspects that you tend to revise more often than others within the text?
I think I would tend to revise a lot of speech, and that's very important to me that is clear, especially in Lesser Bohemians, when what is said is so important to both characters. And I would have to revise sort of internal digressions much less often. Because also although they appear more abstract, they tend to be more linear, and they just go from their beginning to their end and then they stop. Whereas the speech, you can find yourself going around in circles a bit, and you have to be careful of that.
Going round in circles in the revising process, so you'd come back and spend an hour just rewriting one line.
I mean, and there are times quite, where I've spent not an hour, but a week rewriting three lines, which is not a good mental place to get into, and is to be avoided as much as possible. But I would always find with that, and it would usually be around speech or something, where I would just get really just blind to it and really not be able to see clearly, that the way out of that is to always go back to the body. Mm. What's physically happening, and that will show you then that what's happening inside the body is first. And everything else comes on top of that, and because of that, and out of that, and in reaction to it. And so if you get stuck with what's being said, go back to whatever the body is doing.
Mm. And so I guess connected to that, do you read your text out loud when you...
Always. The point of having to go to the doctor and get various throat medications, because I'm spending so many hours a day reading it aloud. So
for that, like a piece of speech that you're working on for a week, you'd be...
That will just go on and on and on and on and on, to the point that sometimes now when I do readings, particularly of Lesser Bohemians, I'll be reading it and I will be thinking that there's something wrong with it, because I can still hear the old words in my head that cut maybe 5 years ago, but had taken, you know, days and days of revising and revising and revising before I just went, fuck it, and cut it.
I mean, it sounds amazing, the rhythm of it. I think when you read it on the page as well, it seems such a vital, integral part of it. But when we saw the reading at the Institut Français as well, to actually see you reading it out loud, is that still part of the... not the logic of it as such, but is that one of the blocks that you can't get past, that each day when you read what you did yesterday, does the rhythm come later, or is that from the start as well? It needs to have
that. That's pretty much from the start. Mm-hmm. And it drives me mad, but if that's not right, then I can't go on until that's right. And that's one of the first things I notice when I go back. Is, oh, there's too many words in that sentence. Mm-hmm. That's really annoying. How do I get to the same meaning with fewer words? The rhyme, you know, it's quite hard.
But you don't write poetry, or you sort of said it, again, this is harking back to the talk that we saw you give, but you said, why do poets get to have all the fun? And I think there's something to be really said for that.
Yeah. That's the thing, that people bring a different part of themselves to poetry. They bring a part of themselves that is prepared to do a little bit of work. They understand that the meaning, or the kernel, or the whatever, the center of the poem will not necessarily just be sitting staring up the page and in a readily accessible way. They know they're going to have to look at that and think about it and bring something of themselves to it in order to get the fullest meaning out of it. If it's an interesting poem, obviously it's a shitty poem, then, you know, it's all there. But, you know, and that's a good thing. Why did that stop for prose? Why did prose just become about an intellectual game? And that annoys me. And I do hold Joyce a bit responsible for that, much as I admire him. But, you know, something got dried up along the way for prose. And I think it's a real shame. You know, it's like Doris Lessing complaining in The Golden Notebook about how, you know, contemporary novels... and this was, you know, back in the 60s, were really now just an outpost of journalism. And I think that was true, and I think that is still true.
It hasn't changed that much, perhaps.
Well, you know, I think there is more going on now, maybe in the last 5-6 years, but for a very long time, I think that door was closed on a prose being allowed to be anything else.
But it still feels like, and this might be a slightly... there are always people doing things in the margins, for want of a better term, but it still seems to be, but it still seems to be something we have to really like hail and make a big deal about when there's any innovation in fiction. I don't understand why that is. Why there seems to be this big, there was an avant-garde and then it just sort of faded away or got ignored. And I don't understand what happened in British culture to make us turn on.
I think the door just got closed. Maybe it was a post-war thing. You know, I know Beckett has called the last modernist, and he was definitely the last man standing out of that, all of that movement. I think publishing changed, and the idea of difficulty in literature became taboo. I think publishers decided what people wanted and that they didn't want all of this effort and all this mess, and they wanted everything to be clear. And, you know, after the war, there were to be no, you know, there was to be nothing difficult. And And I think there was a lot of cynicism, and I think, you know, postmodernism sort of poisoned the well as well, that people associated modernism with postmodernism and that kind of slightly snide superior attitude towards everyone and all literature that goes hand in hand with a lot of that. And that's a shame. And I think what's, you know, the point of modernism got lost. The idea of bringing the reader as close to human experience as possible got lost. But I think given, you know, the increasing influence of the internet and social media and people's sort of alienation from the physical, from physical interaction, I think literature and what it can do and the power it has to connect deep parts of people, of the inner life, of the soul, and I say that in a non-religious way, that has become more important than ever. And literature has to sort of become a distillation of the best of itself.
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't need it to tell you what, you know, a wedding dress in 1850 looked like anymore.
Yeah.
That's not its job now. You don't need it to describe what it's like to watch young men being blown up on the battlefield, because you can turn on the TV and there it is.
But there are these parts that other things can't quite explore, I think.
Yeah, fiction can, and I think that's where fiction that's willing to work outside the social realist framework, that's where it really has the upper hand on everything else, because it has a capacity to try and talk about the parts of life that are lost in grammar and all those very individual experiences that we have. That we, as soon as we start to talk about it, all we have are the cliches of language to describe them with. And it loses its particularity and its peculiarity because it just suddenly becomes like, oh, yeah, everyone else says that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you try to find a language that's really capturing that part of life and making itself in the image of life rather than making life in the image of language, then it's doing its job.
Yeah, I think when we were talking before, it was really interesting. I think we were talking about what you would, felt you would lose if you didn't have fiction, and you're saying something along the lines of it was your way of understanding the world or understanding what's true in the world. And I found that a really interesting approach to fiction. I guess I wanted to sort of ask around that how much control you see within that process of uncovering the true or uncovering what the world is about. When a lot of writers sort of talk about writing as a sort of almost dreamlike state, on a good day, getting into a sort of zone where you're not necessarily in control, but almost taking down what passes through you. I wonder what your thoughts were in terms of the level of control or lack of control you have when you feel you are uncovering something true. Is it something that you're is it sort of an active process for you to kind of discover the world around you, or is it somehow less active and more passive to sort of let the world come to you and find that zone to exist
no
in?
I mean, for me it's not a passive experience at all. It's almost like a kind of a hyper active state where you have to get yourself into a position where everything is at its most sensitive, which means that everything can be at its most painful and most difficult, but also at its most wonderful. But you have to, you know, get yourself into a position where you are open to what will come. And it does sound like, you know, some kind of crazy automatic writing exercise, but there is that, and it's just about allowing yourself to be, allowing the sort of the brain to stop being the generator, but to somehow allow it to become just a conduit for the subconscious. And so it's something that you are not completely in control of until it's on the page. Once it's on the page, then you're kind of writer's eye and the writer's ear, and the critic within comes out and works on that. But it's the it's that moment of getting it onto the page that's the most important.
And how do you find getting to that point? Is it, I mean, something that you have to sit staring at the page for at least half an hour before you find the words
are
flowing?
No, I very rarely sit and stare at a page. For me, everything's just about doing. Just sit down and start to write. Whatever shit comes into your head, put it on the page. It doesn't matter what it is. Get it on the page, because then afterwards you can cut it all, you can fix it, you can do whatever you want, but until it's on the page, nothing is possible.
And do you find generally, say you're sitting writing for a few hours in a stint, do you find generally the best stuff is at the start, at the end of that stint, in the middle, or it just varies
from
day to day?
I can never tell. Sometimes it takes a little while to warm up and get into it. Sometimes you're right there at the start. Sometimes you get stuck in a rut and you're going round and round and round and round. And then in the last 5 minutes before you have to go and collect the child from school, suddenly there it is. But you never know. And some days it doesn't happen and you're just foul all night, you know, and vile and hate the world and yourself and can think that's the end of it all forever, and then get up the next morning and then the first thing you write down is the right thing. You just can't tell.
And can you tell, do you ever write something that you think is no good and you feel you've not got into that state of being a conduit or exploring what is really true, and then the next day you look back at it and go, actually no, there was something in there, I don't know why I didn't realize that yesterday.
Yeah, and that's why usually I would start the day with rereading what I'd written the day before. One, it helps to just get back into that rhythm again, so it's you're keeping the same tone. But two, you can't ever judge. In the moment that you write something, you can't know whether that's of value or not, whether it's going to be any good. It might feel great, but that doesn't mean anything. Or it might feel shit. That also doesn't mean anything. It's you need to have a little time away. And then sometimes you need a lot of time away. But how you feel about it in the moment that you write it means almost nothing.
Mm. I mean, I'm interested in that difference between writing out three sentences in a row and being able to leave that and think I'll look at it tomorrow and not going back and just obsessing over.
Yeah.
Like that's, I don't know, that just takes a discipline, isn't it? That's a personal discipline. There's
but
no
also, 'cause the thing is, it's also work. And because people tend to think about writing and talk about writing as though kind of the muse descends and, you know, you just sit there and it all flows and there's the pragmatist all the time that has to be at work as well. It's like, if I keep doing that, I'm never going to write the rest of this book. And so you do have to stop. But also I'm not a perfectionist. I don't think there's anything wrong with there being, not mistakes, but being oddities within a book. I kind of resent the tyranny of that sort of creative writing mantra, tone, 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 and everything has to have, like, this is above all other things. And you just think, well, Brothers Karamazov, a lot of loose ends in there, still a great book, you know.
I don't think he'd get through the MFA.
Well, yeah, maybe not, but I think this is bullshit, since when were great novels? Like, fine, there are some books that are great and the tone is, and it's all very succinct and everything's tied up and it's beautifully done, but that actually isn't the point of literature. And I don't think that people love a book more because of its tone. I think critics like to review it well because of its tone, because it's an easy thing to talk about. And they often will talk about that than about the content or...
I guess tied into that, one sort of conversation that's sort of going on at the moment in terms of writers being sort of morally virtuous or representing certain morals in their work. Talking about literature as something that's trying to uncover the true. Do you see that truth as being something that may in some circumstances be different from truths that you use in the everyday world? The truth that you're exploring in a book may even be in opposition to truths that you live by, but it's nevertheless the truth of a book or literature.
Absolutely. I mean, and I think that is the the most important thing that a writer can do, the only rule that a writer should have is a refusal of the simplistic. A writer has to embrace what is complex always, even if that doesn't sound great, even if it's embarrassing, even if it's not the, if even if it's making them look like the kind of person they don't want to be. This is, that doesn't matter. If you want to be that person, go do another job.
So that was Ema McBride. We'd like to thank Ema again for being so generous with her time and coming to speak with us again, following the particularly hot, quick chat that we had to have in a sweltering French institute in the middle of summer. It was very good of her to come out to find and see us. Thank you for listening. You can find out all about Ema's work online.
And you can find us at unsignedmethods.co.uk, or you can find me and my writing at lachlanbloom.com.
And I'm jamiebatchin.com or at jamiebatchin on Twitter. And please, if you like the podcast, spread the word, let people know, and we'd love to hear from you. Cheers.